Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Anderson Producing versus Coke Oil.
May it please the court, Mr. John M. Zukowski is an argument for petitioners. Petitioners are reserved 5 minutes.
Good morning. I'm here on behalf of Anderson Producing, Inc. I represented them also in the Court of Appeal and in the trial court below. This is a judgment collection fraud case. The Court of Appeal took a judgment that it otherwise found to be legally, factually sufficient and reversed it solely on the basis that an attorney had to be disqualified and the matter to be tried. The problem with the Court of Appeal's decision is that they tried to force a square peg into a round hole. And as always the case, the resulting fit is wrong. The round hole is the so-called advocate witness rule that's best articulated in the Code of Professional Responsibility, Section 3.08. The square peg is unfortunately my partner, K. Ray Campbell. Mr. Campbell does not fit into the hole because he was not an advocate witness at the trial, which is the subject of this appeal. There is no doubt he was a witness in that matter. He was a material and important witness. And in order to understand how he fell into that role, it only takes a moment to understand how the case developed.
Would it be fair to say that the case could not have been proved without his testimony?
Absolutely correct. He was the only witness that could be presented on behalf of Anderson. There was no one else that Anderson could designate, and that's best shown by the fact that we did present Mr. Anderson, who's the principal of the company at the trial. A lot has been made of his testimony that basically, honestly, he testified he did not know firsthand what had happened here, and he testified to that. It was then incumbent upon Mr. Campbell to explain the circumstances for the litigation.
There is an allusion in the brief, in the briefs perhaps, that your firm was compensated, at least in the first litigation, on the basis of a contingent fee. Is that in the record?
Yes, it is.
Was there a separate compensation arrangement as to the garnishment proceeding, or was there? Was it also contingent?
No, that was handled on time and hour.
But the first case was on a contingent fee basis.
There was an original trial. I'm confused by saying the first case. There was an original trial that ended in a judgment that was on time and hour basis. Then we went into collecting that judgment. Garnishments were filed. That was on a time and hour basis. And when we moved into the cause of action and the resulting judgment that's before this court, that was on a contingency basis.
So it would be fair to say then that Mr. Campbell's law firm, and I suppose Mr. Campbell, stood to benefit by his testimony.
That is correct.
Was he asked about that in cross-examination?
Yes, he was. In fact, a lot was made of the fact that Mr. Campbell had been a lawyer, and that was brought out in cross-examination by one of the defendant's counsel. One of the points we would like to make is that under that questioning, it was clearly established what Mr. Campbell's role at trial was, that he was not appearing as a lawyer in the case during the trial. He would not be arguing the case. His role was simply one as a witness, and that was clearly brought out.
He was still an expert witness. Was he getting any additional compensation for his testimony beyond that he got as a member of the law firm?
No, sir.
So he was an expert witness being compensated on a contingency fee basis.
The expert witness is really a misnomer in this case. The reason that it comes up as an expert witness, there was only one set of interrogatories that were proffered to Anderson during this entire litigation. And the only question they asked about witnesses were about expert witnesses. And because Mr. Campbell was going to be a witness in the case, and there was going to be attorney fee testimony, it was responded that he would be an expert. But in fact, if the court would look at the record, the testimony given by Mr. Campbell was minuscule in regard to being an expert. Most of his testimony was in regard to presenting the documents. There were 265 exhibits in this case. The documents that he obtained in discovery that really proved the basis of the case.
It is a violation of the rules of disciplinary procedure for a lawyer to compensate a witness based upon the outcome of the case, is it not?
Yes.
Why isn't that a problem here?
Mr. Campbell was not being compensated for his time on the witness stand.
He was doing that free.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, Mr. Campbell's billing stopped at the time that he became a witness in this case. Just to bear out the reason...
That is semantical. I mean, testimony was going to make a difference in how the case came.
Yes, that's
which was going to make a difference in his pocket.
Yes, that's correct, because the firm was on a contingency fee basis on it. But as far as any kind of a billing basis or any testimony in that regard, that was stopped.
The rule says a lawyer shall not pay or acquiesce in the payment of compensation to a witness contingent upon the content of the testimony or the outcome of the case. But that's where Mr. Campbell was, is it not?
The agreement was arranged with the firm prior to Mr. Campbell ever having any knowledge that he was going to be a witness in this matter. I want to make that clear, that the fact that Mr. Campbell would have to be a witness in the case was developed as the garnishment action evolved into this fraud case against him. So there was not a fee agreement entered into at the time with Mr. Campbell when he knew he was going to be the main witness.
If your firm had to withdraw from this case, let's suppose we affirm the judgment of the court of appeals, how would you eventually obtain any compensation?
Well, first of all, the Beaumont Court of Appeals did not disqualify my firm. The Beaumont Court of Appeals disqualified Mr. Campbell as being plaintiff's counsel. They, although the motion, original motion to disqualify, was also to disqualify the firm, the Beaumont Court of Appeals did not disqualify my firm or myself individually from representing Anderson in this case. In fact, depending on what happens here, we would have to go back and discuss with Anderson what, in fact, we would do as far as continuing representation or the fee agreement under this case.
Why did you have Mr. If he was totally acting as a witness, why did he sit at counsel table?
Because he was the only person who had the information in regard to the matter. I would have anyone who was my main witness sitting next to me. He was there to, in fact, keep me informed in regard to the paperwork, things of that nature. It was a matter of having your most informed witness sitting next to you during the trial.
Did opposing counsel object to his presence at counsel table?
No, they never did. They never raised that in any manner. The only time his role was raised was in that cross-examination that's been set forth in the briefing. That's when they raised it and tried to make a point.
Based on the Court of Appeals opinion in the case, disqualifying Mr. Campbell but not your firm, what would be the result on remand?
Well, that's the truly troublesome thing we find here. We find that the result of this overturning is illusory. Mr. Campbell would have to again appear as a witness at the next trial. He is the only witness for Anderson. I know of no basis under which he can be disqualified as a witness. There certainly hasn't been any basis of that set forth. He will again appear at trial. We have not been disqualified. We'll talk to Anderson, but at Anderson's consent, I believe that my firm could again represent Anderson at the trial. And so, in fact, we would have just an entire repeat of what we already had here. The few things that Koch could point out, the fact that Mr. Campbell had signed a couple of pleadings, the fact that he sat at counsel table, all things that you can't do anything, that's in the past, that it's done. Those will all be facts that are still there. And we would just retry the case again to perhaps a different result, perhaps the same result. The fact of the matter is there would be no change as far as what the Court of Appeals tried to remedy here. Same witness, same lawyers, based upon Anderson's consent to the same lawyers representing him. There were two points to the Court of Appeals.
I understand that since this case was tried, we've amended these rules and made them a little clearer, but why on the face of the rule aren't you in trouble? It says a lawyer shall not continue employment in a pending adjudicatory proceeding. And then it has some unless clauses.
The basic rule is set up with regard to a lawyer appearing as an advocate before the tribunal. That is the first sentence of Rule 3.08. A lawyer should not accept or continue employment as an advocate before a tribunal.
Well, I think you're taking A and B and putting them. I mean, that's the rule now, but the rule before 1994 was accept or continue employment in a contemplated or pending adjudicatory proceeding.
The rules were changed in 1990.
1990?
Your Honor, it changed from the disciplinary rules to the CPR in 1990. I believe I'm looking at the 1990 codification of 3.08. One of the confusions I think the Beaumont Court of Appeals had is although they talked about the Code of Professional Responsibility in 3.08, in fact, they ruled as if it was still the disciplinary rule, which had the language the court is talking about. It was a prohibition, but it's conceived by the rule itself and particularly by the comments. It's very clear that all the rule is going to is a prohibition to a lawyer being an advocate before the tribunal. And particularly comment 8 makes it very clear. You're not talking about pretrial preparation. You're not talking about any kind of negotiations or assistance or even pleadings. What you're talking about is causing confusion in the mind of the trier of fact, the fact that you have a dual role at trial. You're appearing as a witness, and then you're standing up and you're arguing the issue to the court. And then the jury is going to somehow be confused at what is evidence and what is argument. That is what the rule goes to now very clearly, and the fact that there is that dichotomy of role. What is very important here is that Mr. Campbell took no part of the advocacy whatsoever. He never spoke in the courtroom at any time other than from the witness stand, with two exceptions, outside the hearing of the jury, in direct response to questions that were posed
and
to him.
Doesn't the rule as it's currently written contemplate that the lawyer's firm would continue in the representation of the client?
Yes, comment 8 specifically speaks to that, saying that at the client's consent, you can go ahead and have another lawyer represent the party in the litigation where his partner is a witness. And in fact, the rule and the commentaries are such that it's clear that that is the client's decision in that circumstance, because it's a concern about a possible prejudice to the client as opposed to opposing party. And Anderson did consent. That consent is in the record. It would not have made sense, frankly, for Anderson not to, because my firm had so much background as far as the original matter and the development of this matter. The second part of the Court of Appeals decision, not only did they have to find that, in fact, there was a violation of this rule, they had to find that it was reversible error. And the manner they had to approach that was on the basis that there was some kind of prejudice to Koch, sufficient prejudice to, in fact, make it necessary to cause a reversal. The Court of Appeals also focused on the wrong thing. They focused solely on the importance of Mr. Campbell as a witness and not on the predicate finding, which is this confusion in the dual roles. They spent no time in regard to Mr. Campbell's role as an advocate in the trial. They almost seemed to assume it without ever pointing anything out other than the fact that he signed 5 pleadings over a spectrum of time, the last one a good 6 months before the trial of this matter. It's basically our position
Mr.
that...
Mr. Kowski, is it in the record of Campbell taking the position that he withdrew 18 months before the trial of this case, but isn't that inconsistent with him continuing to sign off on the pleadings as the attorney of record?
No, I don't believe so, because the fact of the matter is, again, a firm our size, there were only two pleadings signed after that 18-month period of time. There was an amended supplemental pleading and then a motion to sever. There were only two pleadings. I'm not sure it's in the record. I can explain that each one of those were kind of emergency-type situations where there wasn't someone else around, and that's why he signed the pleadings at the time. But there's no inconsistency in that, because as I understand the rule is that you cannot take part in any of the presentation to the trier of fact or the tribunal. And Mr. Campbell never made an appearance in front of the court where he acted as the advocate, never once. I did all of the advocacy throughout the entire proceeding, all motions, any appearance in front of the court, and particularly the trial. So.
Would you tell us how you distinguish the decision of Mosley versus Curry?
Well, yeah, in Mosley versus Curry, it was clear that the lawyer had acted as a witness and as an advocate. He was an expert witness, but in fact his expert testimony went to the essential elements of the case. It was a negligence case, and he basically was testifying that based on his expert opinion, there was a sufficient level of negligence in the case. He also was the only attorney of record. In this case, and he did the presentation, in this case, Mr. Campbell never made any presentation to the court of any kind or nature. And I think that's a distinguishing factor. There was that dual role in Monty. There is not the dual role in this case.
Just for the record, the words "as an advocate" were added in 1994. In the rule, and you tried to turn the rule without advocacy in it. I know there's comments that support this, but we also have a situation where the other side was not notified for 17 months. I know you don't have to do that, but that's one of the ways you can get out from this rule, is to promptly notify and show the substantial hardship. But was there any, and was there any attempt to try to qualify under that exception to this rule?
That comes under Section A of the rule,
right.
And we do not fit under Section A of this rule. And that's the problem I have with the Court of Appeals opinion. That's where the lawyer is going to continue to be an advocate and a witness. And then you go ahead and use that rule.
But it doesn't say that. At the time that this case was tried, it said you shall not accept or continue employment unless you have a contemplated or pending adjudicatory proceeding. If the lawyer is a witness necessary to establish an essential fact.
Yes.
Is what the rule said. That seems to me it fits squarely in your, into your situation.
As I,
we can read some comment and maybe look at the 1994 amendment as an attempt to clarify what the original intent of the rule was, but just on the face of the rule, it seems to me it fits this situation.
Well, again.
And B is not the one that fits, it's A.
Well, and again, the way we interpreted this is we do not think A or B applies, because as soon as the decision was made that the lawyer would not appear to present the matter to the court, would no longer act as a presenting lawyer in the case, at that point, A or B do not apply. You're simply going to C, which is at the time the lawyer is going to be a witness and someone else from his firm is going to present the matter. That's why we don't think A or B applies. We think, in fact, it's subsection C that applies, and it becomes a question whether, in fact, Mr. Campbell, in any way, was an advocate at the time of trial, and he was not. I understand that from the court that the word advocate was added in 1994, but if the court looks at the case law that has been handed down in regard to this rule, and I'm talking about the Ayers case, I'm talking about the Mousy case, it's always spoken in terms of the advocate-witness rule, and I think it's pretty clear that since the codification of professional responsibility code, that in fact the rule has been set up to dichotomize between this role of an advocate and a witness. Just because you're a lawyer does not disqualify you. It's the advocacy role.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Loftus, to present argument for the respondent.
May it please the honorable court, my name is Tom Loftus, and I represent Coke Oil Company, the respondent in this proceeding. This case involves the application of a rule of ethics. And as a rule of ethics, it should be strictly enforced by this court. Likewise, any exception to a rule of ethics should be narrowly construed. The rule...
We said these rules of ethics do not automatically... They are not necessarily disqualification rules.
I agree.
It's apples and oranges, except sometimes you can't tell the difference in the facts.
I understand.
So, strictly, I mean, there's really no way to strictly apply this rule in terms of a disqualification. We have to look at it by analogy, don't we?
Your Honor, and I speak by analogy, that the court should examine this case very carefully, is the point I made.
Mr. Loftus, can you disqualify Mr. Campbell from appearing as a witness in the second case?
No, Your Honor.
Can you keep Mr. Bukowski from representing Anderson Oil in the subsequent case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Then what changes anything about this case based on, I guess, the Beaumont's decision? What changes now other than it's just a second trial?
I believe that his sitting at counsel table had a direct impact on the jury. I believe the way that he presented himself to the jury as an attorney for Anderson was improper.
What did you do to try to stop that behavior?
Your Honor, the cross-examination that occurred did not explore, I believe, the nature of his association with Anderson, other than pointing out that he was an attorney.
Well, for instance, you knew he was going to be an attorney from before the trial started. You knew he was going to be a witness, Mr. Campbell. Did you ever seek to invoke the rule? Did you ever seek to invoke the rule and put him outside the hearing of the proceeding?
No, Your Honor.
Did you object to him sitting at counsel table on the record?
No, Your Honor.
Why wasn't any prejudice then invited by you? You're not exercising the rights which the rule provides.
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. The rule, as the court has noted, states that a lawyer shall not accept or continue employment in a contemplated or pending adjudicatory proceeding. In the petitioner's application for writ of error, the petitioner stated that Mr. Campbell was aware that he would be a witness 18 months before trial. The trial was in December of 92, that means in June of 91, he became aware that he would be a witness, the conspiracy action against Koch having been filed only 3 months prior to that. And yet, 18 months went by before Mr. Campbell notified Koch that he would be a witness. The rule requires two conditions for a lawyer to continue employment. First, he has to promptly notify opposing counsel. And second, he has to show that it would not work and disqualification of the lawyer would work a substantial hardship on the client. With regard to the prompt requirement, that has to be a case-by-case determination within the context of each case, what is and is not prompt. But I believe...
You agree with me that the word as an advocate was added in 1994?
Yes, sir.
Don't the comments, isn't opposing counsel correct that the comments and such case development that there is under this make clear that the lawyer's appearance was in the advocacy role and not in the office role? In other words, that the whole purpose of this rule is to prevent the trier of fact from becoming confused.
Yes, Your Honor. But I also think that there are mechanics that have to be observed for fairness to the other side, and that is the substantive basis for the prompt notification to opposing counsel requirement.
If you had gotten this notification in June of 1991, what would you have done differently?
I believe that we would have pursued a more diligent course of discovery with regard to the alleged knowledge that Mr. Campbell possessed. The fact of the matter was, we found out only 3 weeks before trial that he would be a witness.
Did you object to the late disclosure?
We filed a motion for disqualification, which was overruled by the trial court.
Did you have an outstanding discovery request asking for the identification of persons with knowledge of relevant facts and experts?
And that was the only way we found out about it. It was in response to the interrogatory 3 weeks before trial that the status of Mr. Campbell as a witness was disclosed to us. In other words, he did not do it voluntarily as required by the rule, but did it in response to a discovery request.
And do you contend that that was too late under the rules, that he should have been excluded as a witness or the case continued or some other remedy might have been more appropriate than disqualification?
Yes, Your Honor, or that simply he did not follow the requirements of Rule 3.08 requiring prompt disclosure.
So you think Rule 308 is an alternative to, say, a motion for sanctions to exclude a late designated witness or continuance
Is that right?
Quite frankly, I have not explored that, Your Honor, but that I think that that is certainly a possibility.
You did not make a motion to exclude him, I take it.
I'm sorry.
You did not make a motion to exclude him on the basis of designation within the 30-day window.
I don't believe so, no, Your Honor.
And you did not move for a continuance to give you more time for discovery?
That's correct, Your Honor. The rule also requires that there would be a showing of substantial hardship. In this case, there is nothing in the record that shows that Anderson Producing Company would suffer substantial hardship if the disqualification motion had been sustained.
Was Mr. Campbell's testimony both fact and expert testimony?
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Lofton says, as the rule, it seems, contemplates Mr. Campbell assuming that he's going to be representing Anderson and also being a witness to get permission to do that. It's his obligation to prove that otherwise would be a substantial hardship. But the posture of this case comes from Coke trying to disqualify Mr. Campbell from representing that client. Arguably, wouldn't Coke have the burden of showing that it would not be a substantial hardship to Anderson for them to lose their lawyer?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, but even if that were the case, I think the record supports an affirmative showing of no hardship. The record shows that there was 18 months between the time Mr. Campbell realized he would be a witness and the trial of the case. I first believe that, you know, whatever the evidence or documents or facts were that Mr. Campbell, through admittedly only investigatory actions, not firsthand knowledge, discovered that enabled him to testify, could certainly be assembled and presented at trial rather than secondhand through the petitioner's attorney. Documents can be brought into evidence other than the attorney authenticating the documents. If Mr. Campbell's investigation convinced him that Coke had engaged in a conspiracy, then the individuals with whom he spoke could have been deposed or brought to trial rather than coming through the person of Mr. Campbell. So I think if you examine from that perspective, you find that there was no hardship that would have been suffered in this context, because Mr. Campbell didn't have to testify. Mr. Campbell could have presented the evidence firsthand through the people that he talked to. Instead, he took the stand, clothed with the authority and knowledge of an attorney, and told the jury, in essence, I have special knowledge, and here's what Coke did, and I'm the lawyer that knows these facts. And I think it's from that perspective shows that Mr. Campbell's testimony was reasonably calculated to cause error and probably did cause error. So there was no showing of substantial hardship. And the record has an affirmative.
Your position is no substantial hardship because his testimony could have easily been replaced by other testimony, and therefore, since it was so easily replaced, he's indicating it could not have been a substantial hardship to have replaced him as the lawyer?
Yes, Your Honor. Comment 8 that the petitioner relies on also requires that the client give his informed consent to the testimony by the lawyer. In this case, again, there was 18 months between the time Mr. Campbell says he became aware of his necessity as a witness and trial. His status as a witness went to the conspiracy charge against Coke. It seems beyond argument that he would have discussed the nature of his special knowledge regarding this conspiracy issue with Mr. Anderson, his client, in order to obtain that informed consent. And yet at trial, when Mr. Anderson was asked if he had any knowledge of a conspiracy by Coke, the answer was a flat no. I believe that clearly shows that there was no informed consent by Anderson with regard to Mr. Campbell's testimony as a witness. Therefore, they don't satisfy the requirements of comment 8, an exception to rule 3.8. They don't satisfy the either requirement of 3.085, an exception to the general rule. Instead, what happened was in June of 91, Mr. Campbell became aware that he was a witness in this matter and that he would testify, and yet, contrary to rule 3.08, he continued his employment in a contemplated or adjudicatory proceeding. No notice was given to Koch on a timely basis. Instead, he sat on the information until the last minute, and then only in response to a discovery request.
Did you ask Mr. Anderson how it could be that he had no knowledge of any conspiracy on the part of your client, and yet his own lawyer, one of his lawyers who represented him, got on the witness stand and testified to the existence of a conspiracy?
No, Your Honor.
And you're asking us to infer from that that Mr. Campbell did not get the consent of his client?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honors, in conclusion, I believe that fairness, equity, and the proper administration of justice require that this case go down for a new trial.
And what's going to happen? Same thing?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe the same thing. I think another point to think about as far as was there prejudice is to just take a look at the result in this case, and this is something the Court of Appeals noted, and that was this was a garnishment case. Koch had collected only $18,000 in revenue, of which all but about $3,700 was paid to the rightful title holders. The remaining $3,700 was deposited into the registry of the court. And yet this jury, confused as it was, primarily as a result of the testimony of Mr. Campbell, petitioner's attorney, rendered a verdict in the total amount of $9.5 million.
You have other points that go to that issue that the Court of Appeals did not reach, don't you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you tell us again how the new trial will differ from the one we've already had?
Well, it's hard to say exactly how, Your Honor, but I believe that there will be a different result. I believe that...
What relief are you asking from us other than another shot at the jury?
That's all I'm asking for, Your Honor, is that the Court of Appeals' opinion be affirmed, recognizing that the Rule 3.08 was violated and that the proper remedy for that violation is a new trial.
It's not disqualification, it's a new trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
A couple of responsive points. First of all, in regard to discovery, Koch sought no discovery in this matter of written time of any kind or nature. The interrogatories were proffered on October 15th by a co-defendant. Our responses were due November 18th, which means we were within the 30-day rule because trial was December 7th. Therefore, we answered timely. In fact, we answered on October 12th before our full 30-day period had run. The fact of the matter is that Koch never inquired about any witnesses of any nature. The interrogatories that were proffered to Anderson only inquired in regard to expert witnesses, did not ask in regard to relevant witnesses with knowledge of relevant facts. We answered them and at that time made a full disclosure. The court, even though discovery was cut off, allowed Koch to take Mr. Campbell's deposition. They had a full deposition of Mr. Campbell at that time and document production. Before trial, they had all the discovery or more discovery than they were entitled to under the docket control order, which said that discovery had already been terminated. Go to substantial hardship. They keep pointing out that one phrase by Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson answered the question honestly. He had no firsthand knowledge of this conspiracy. The fact of the matter is Mr. Campbell was questioned and Mr. Anderson was questioned in the fact that the only witness that could be presented on behalf of Anderson was Mr. Campbell. Clearly, it was shown during the trial and was never controverted or contradicted at trial that Mr. Campbell was the only witness that could be presented on behalf of Anderson. There was never even so much as a hint that somebody else could be presented. And I think it's very important to note that Koch presented its own in-house counsel as witnesses during the trial. They only had two or three witnesses. The witness that spent the most time at trial for Koch was Koch's in-house counsel. When I raised that in the Court of Appeals thought I was alibying Mr. Campbell's role. I was not. I was simply pointing out that it was necessary for the lawyers to testify in this case because in great part it was their interaction that created the factual basis for the lawsuit. Finally, in regard to informed consent, and counsel misunderstands informed consent. Informed consent is not for the witness. Informed consent comes under subsection C of 3.08. It is for the lawyer in the firm that is going to continue to represent the client, not for the witness. I obtained and I received Anderson's informed consent to participate at Anderson's trial counsel. That's where the informed consent comes, not for Mr. Campbell to get an informed consent to act as a witness. Mr. Campbell, I think, has a duty to appear as a witness. He certainly could have been compelled by subpoena to appear as a witness. It's my role as an attorney that the informed consent was sought and received from Anderson.
Mr. Loftus has taken the position that one of the things that might be changed in the trial court, actually didn't say it, and gathered from his argument that his concern with Mr. Campbell is that he apparently emphasized for the jury that he was Anderson's attorney and that this information was gained because of his work with Anderson on this case and that sort of thing. Is that your recollection of the presentation of the case for Mr. Campbell?
It was not emphasized, but by the nature of the case, it will come out. It did come out and will come out again because he was acting as Anderson's lawyer in a garnishment action and seeking discovery, written discovery, document production, and depositions in regard to the response to the garnishment that led to the change of the lawsuit to a fraud lawsuit. So it was purposely not emphasized by Anderson, but nevertheless it came out simply by the development of the case that he was a lawyer and this is how he obtained the documents that were being presented, which is another reason why in fact Mr. Campbell had to appear as a witness. He authenticated the documents. He's the one who obtained them. He's the one who questioned people about their meaning and the various things you find in documents.
If we disagree with the Court of Appeals with regards to their construction of 3.08, are there some unaddressed points of error that Koch had for the Court of Appeals that the Court of Appeals did not address?
Yes.
Will we have to remand to the Court of Appeals?
I think there are five issues that the court addressed the first and the second issues. One point out, the court found that there was legally and factually sufficient evidence to support the jury's verdict in regard to the main issue, which is was there fraud, a proper finding of fraud in this case. I'm not exactly quoting the issue, but it was the preliminary or basic issue. Was there a good fraud finding here? But there were some other preliminary issues after that. There was some question about the punitive damage question in this case. One or two others, I don't recall, but they were not ruled on by the court.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument. And the second clause will be taken another group proceeding.
The audience, please rise.